KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Scott Simon. This hour, the Supreme Court issues an order to block the Trump administration from using an 18th century law to deport Venezuelans. President Trump's call to replace the head of the Fed and lower interest rates. Also, today's 250th anniversary of the first shots of the American Revolution with Rick Atkinson. And Anna Bassett, a mother of four who asked herself,
do you feel that you need to reassess your place in the world as you realize you have lived half your life?
She returns to college at the age of 48. And Andrew Ron's new film, The Wedding Banquet. First, we have our newscast. Today is Saturday, April 19, 2025.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. The Supreme Court has temporarily blocked the Trump administration from deporting a group of Venezuelan men under an old wartime statute, which allows the federal government to fast-track deportations for foreigners deemed a threat by authorities. NPR's Juliana Kim reports.
The Supreme Court brief came early Saturday morning. It ordered the Trump administration to halt deportations for Venezuelans held in a detention center in northern Texas. The Trump administration accuses the group of men of being gang members. The Supreme Court stepped in after the American Civil Liberties Union alerted them that immigration authorities were moving to quickly prepare removals under the Alien Enemies Act, despite the Supreme Court placing restrictions on how it can use the law. Some 100 migrants have already been deported under the wartime statute, according to federal officials. That includes a group of men who were taken to prison in El Salvador. Juliana Kim, NPR News.
Democratic Senator Chris Van Hollen is back home after a visit to El Salvador this week. He went to see Kilmer Abrego Garcia, who had been illegally deported to a prison there. Van Hollen was unable to visit the prison, but Abrego Garcia was brought to his hotel where they met. Van Hollen says this case isn't just about one man, but the rule of law.
As I said, and the courts have said, from the Supreme Court to the Fourth Circuit to the District Court, what this is about is adhering to the Constitution, to the right of due process. That's right. And that's why we say, bring Kilmer home, so he can be afforded his rights under the Constitution.
Van Hollen says Abrego Garcia told him he's been transferred from the prison to a detention center with better conditions. Customs officials said in a court filing that he had been deported by mistake, and a federal appeals court affirmed last week that he is entitled to due process. The U.S. and Iran started a second round of indirect talks over Iran's nuclear program today. The discussions are being held in Rome and mediated by the Omani foreign minister. NPR's Adil Al-Shalchi reports.
The Iranian state news agency said that Iran's foreign minister Abbas Araghchi met with the Italian foreign minister ahead of indirect talks with U.S. Middle East envoy Steve Witkoff. The first round of talks were held last weekend in the Omani capital of Muscat, when Iran's foreign minister said the two sides discussed the lifting of American sanctions on the country and Iran's nuclear program. Trump said he wants a diplomatic solution with Iran, but has repeatedly mentioned the possibility of military strikes if a deal isn't agreed to. During his last term as president, Trump pulled out of an Obama-era agreement which aimed to limit Iran's nuclear capabilities. Hadil Al-Shalchi, NPR News.
This is NPR News in Washington. Federal authorities are investigating the crash of a small plane in Nebraska last night. The sheriff's office says the bodies of three people have been recovered. The plane was traveling along the Platte River when it crashed into the water near Fremont, about 37 miles west of Omaha. Hundreds of rallies, protests, and civic events are expected across the country today in what organizers are calling a day of action against President Trump and his policy agenda. Bruce Kahnweiser reports.
Under the umbrella of the 50-51 movement, which stands for 50 states, 50 protest, one movement, grassroots organizers across the country are developing their own events. Here in New York, a central theme will be support for immigrants. There's strong opposition here to helping federal ICE agents arresting immigrants with the aim of deporting them. And with Earth Day approaching on Tuesday, rallygoers are expected to ramp up calls to fight climate change. President Trump has signed executive orders in an attempt to revive the country's coal industry. 2 weeks ago, during the hands-off rally here, thousands protested what many called President Trump's assault on democracy. For NPR News, I'm Bruce Kahnweiser in New York.
It was 250 years ago today that the American Revolution began. Thousands gathered in Massachusetts to watch the reenactment of the battles of Lexington and Concord. The reenactors with 18th-century muskets recreated the shot heard round the world in Lexington and the battle in Concord. Organizers expect hundreds of thousands of visitors will attend the events throughout the weekend. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Thank you for being with us. The Supreme Court overnight took issue with the Trump administration's use of the Alien Enemies Act. An early morning order temporarily blocks President Trump from deporting Venezuelans under the wartime law who were held in the Blue Bonnet Detention Center in Texas. NPR's immigration policy reporter Ximena Bustillo has been following this story. Ximena, thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
What's the order say?
Well, in a brief order issued after midnight Eastern time, justices wrote that the government is directed to not remove any member of the, quote, putative class of detainees from the United States until further order from the court. These would be some of the Venezuelan migrants being held at the Blue Bonnet facility in Texas. Justices Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito dissented.
And what spurred this order?
Well, earlier, the Supreme Court had decided that the administration could continue deporting under the act. This was a few weeks ago, but only if detainees were given due process to challenge their removal under the Alien Enemies Act. The American Civil Liberties Union Friday afternoon filed multiple documents in court that showed immigration authorities were moving quickly to restart removals under the Alien Enemies Act, despite the previous Supreme Court's request for that due process. Here's Lee Gillard, one of the lawyers from the ACLU who spoke with my colleague Jasmine Garst.
The government has now given them no notice, given them forms in English that doesn't explain to them how to contest their removal.
He said people got less than a day to contest their removal. So the ACLU filed for a request to have the courts pause the deportations at the D.C. District Court. Judge James Boasberg denied that request because he said he did not believe he had jurisdiction. That prompted the immediate appeal from the ACLU and then the later decision from the Supreme Court.
And Ximena, please remind us what the Supreme Court said when the issue was first brought to them.
The Alien Enemies Act is a rarely used presidential power that Trump invoked last month, right? And it has only been previously used in times of active war, the last time being World War II. Immigrant rights groups originally sued the administration over the use of the act when over 100 people were put on flights and sent to El Salvador, where they're now in a mega prison. Lawyers say that this resulted in mass confusion. Attorneys, even those on behalf of the government, arrived at hearings where clients were missing, and then family members learned that their loved ones were sent to El Salvador and that prison specifically because of social media posts from both the U.S. government and the Salvadoran government. The Trump administration alleges that all people they flew there are members of the Venezuelan gang Tren de Aragua under the Alien Enemies Act, but the lawyers say that many are not, and they never got the opportunity to fight the deportations and allegations in court. During a previous use of the act, lawyers argue that those being removed during World War II still had hearing boards to make their cases.
How does the government's latest attempt to remove people using that Alien Enemies Act line up with what the Supreme Court had previously ordered?
The Justice Department argued that notices comply with previous Supreme Court's guidance on the issue. And I reached out to the Homeland Security Department last night, and they declined to comment on, quote, counterterrorism operations. But they did say that they believe they are complying with the Supreme Court's original ruling. Still, the ACLU argues that they're not. They have since been suing the administration in each individual district court since that first ruling. And judges in several districts have blocked the deportations of people using the Alien Enemies Act. The ACLU alleges that in recent days, many Venezuelan migrants were specifically brought to that Blue Bonnet facility because it is a facility in a court district where deportations have not yet been blocked. The government denies that this is their strategy.
Imena Bustillo, thanks so much.
Thank you.
His termination cannot come fast enough, President Trump said of Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell this week. Powell notes that the president cannot legally fire him over policy disagreements, but it's yet another sign of some of the tensions created by President Trump's tariff policy. We're joined now by Gillian Tett in New York. She's a columnist, member of the editorial board of the Financial Times, and head of King's College, Cambridge. Thanks so much for being with us.
Delighted to be with you.
Does President Trump have a point? Should the Fed be cutting interest rate at a time when markets are down?
Well, the first thing to say is that President Trump definitely does not have a point that he has the right to dictate monetary policy. There are some interpretations of the law which suggest that he can fire the heads of agencies, and the Federal Reserve is indeed an agency, but it's not clear cut. And when it comes to trying to dictate the way that Powell does his job, he does not have the obvious legal power that undoubtedly will be tested at some point in courts. However, when it comes to the question of whether or not interest rates should be lower, the judgment call is extremely nasty because on the one hand, you do have growth slowing down, but you also have inflationary pressures appearing to build. So it's not clear cut either way. And I think given that, most Fed officials would assume the most rational thing to do would be to simply wait and see.
European Central Bank cut rates for the third time this year. Why a different approach than in the U.S.?
Well, essentially, the European Central Bank is not facing the same level of inflationary pressures or homegrown policy uncertainty. And the reason why many central bank officials in the Federal Reserve System say, well, actually, it's premature to act now is because we simply do not know what kind of tariffs are going to be imposed, how and when they'll be imposed, and what impact that will have on prices. If the 145% tariffs on China are maintained and additional tariffs are slapped on other countries, we really could be seeing a very sharp jump in prices in the coming months, a bit like we saw during COVID. And in those circumstances, no central bank would want to cut rates. But if, of course, President Trump does a complete U-turn and removes the tariffs, then we're looking at a very different situation.
Despite the fear of economic pain, do some European states see this as a moment of potential opportunity?
Certainly, there is a sense in Europe now that once they've got over the shock of the first not even 100 days of the Trump administration, many European states think that firstly, that shock might force the European Union to wake up and implement reforms that frankly it should have implemented a long time ago. And secondly, that insofar as the rest of the world is recoiling from what America is doing, there may be a chance for Europe to seem more attractive by default, both as an investment destination and a place to do business with more security and consistency of rules, and also, frankly, just as a place to live.
How do you see the potential consequences of the trade war that seems to be going on between China and the U.S.?
I think the potential consequences of the trade war are extremely serious because, firstly, the two systems are tied together economically in trade through supply chains in areas ranging from the apparel industry through to high-tech sectors where it's completely impossible for any country to be self-sufficient in terms of chips and digital products right now. So ripping that apart is going to be extremely damaging. But on top of that, there's also the risk that ripping apart the financial links between the two countries will also hurt badly by reducing demand for treasuries, US government bonds. And if demand falls, that will push up market interest rates, but also reducing funding for all kinds of American companies.
You've written about the world economy for years. How do you feel we should view this moment?
At the moment, we're living through extreme uncertainty. You know, in some ways, it's resonant or reminds me of both the great financial crisis, where a financial system which had seemed so stable began to wobble and creak, or the COVID pandemic, when, of course, supply chains broke down completely amid extreme uncertainty then. But I'd also take a longer perspective and say what we're living through today is a bit like the kind of intellectual turning points we've seen before in the last 150 years. Before 1914, we had essentially an imperial model of capitalism. And then between the wars, we had protectionism and nationalism and, if you like, nationalist economics dominating. Then after World War II, we had Keynesian economics coming in to play, which was all about the government trying to direct policies in a benign way. And then in the 1980s, we saw the rise of Reaganism and free market neoliberal ideas. What we're seeing now is, I think, in my views, another turning point, the rise of a more nationalist, protectionist tone in policymaking, the acceptance that government has a much bigger role to play in terms of directing how the economy goes going forward, and also rising pressures on companies to be more, quote, patriotic in terms of their own decision-making too. And that's quite a different flavor intellectually for economic policymaking from what we've seen.
Gillian Tett of the Financial Times, thanks so much.
Thank you very much indeed for having me on the show.
40 years ago this month, a terrible idea was born.
There's never been a better taste. There's never been a better Coke. Introducing the greatest taste discovery in 100 years. Introducing the new taste of Coca-Cola.
The American soda giant had been losing market share to rivals and decided to change the decades-old secret formula that made it so popular. On April 23rd, New Coke was rolled out.
Hi, we're New Edition, and we're here to introduce the great new taste of Coca-Cola, the taste of today.
But the new taste fizzled. Coke drinkers didn't like it. Even Pepsi ads made fun of it.
What's the matter, Wilbur?
They changed my Coke.
Something wrong with it?
I know, they sure changed it.
Coulda asked.
What coulda? I stuck with them through three wars and a couple of dust storms, but this is too much.
New Coke was soon dropped, with the old taste returning as Coca-Cola Classic. But after almost 40 years, BJ Lederman still does our theme music, and it's as fresh as ever.
It's a mistake. It's a mistake. It's a mistake.
And you're listening to NPR News.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. Early this morning, the Supreme Court ruled the Trump administration may not deport Venezuelans held in a Texas detention center until further order of the court. The Alien Enemies Act allows the government in wartime to deport foreigners deemed a threat. The deadliest homegrown attack in U.S. history is being remembered today in Oklahoma City. 30 years ago, a truck bomb exploded, killing 168 people, including 19 children. Among the speakers was former President Bill Clinton, who was president that day. And in hockey, the Stanley Cup playoffs get underway tonight. St. Louis will play Winnipeg and Colorado faces Dallas. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Nature Conservancy, committed to protecting and preserving the planet on Earth Day and every day through the bold power of local and global action. nature.org/NPR. From Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon, and now it's time for sports. Hoops, pucks, playoffs. Howard Brandt of Better Lark Media. Howard, thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Scott. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks, my friend. The NBA playoffs begin this afternoon in the West. Let us now pause to praise the Oklahoma City Thunder.
Who?
They had one of the best regular seasons of all time. 68 wins, only 14 losses. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is odds on favorite to win the MVP. Are they on a glide path to the finals?
They're a great team, and I say who only facetiously because normally when a team wins 68 games, you can't stop talking about them. And when you have a player like SGA, it's just they usually dominate the entire conversation. And instead, this was the year of Luka Doncic being traded. So yeah, we're not talking about the best team. They killed everybody this year. You win 68 games. They win by a margin of 12.9, I think, points per game. They are far and away the favorite to win the championship. However, the Boston Celtics are the defending champions, and Cleveland, your Cleveland, let's hear it, Scott.
Cleveland rocks!
Exactly. So the Cleveland Cavaliers were great all season. So you had a lot of good teams out there, but really, if history is a judge, Oklahoma City should be the favorite to get to the finals this year.
NHL playoffs also begin tonight, and for the first time, none of the four American teams of the so-called Original Six, that's the Chicago Blackhawks, Boston Bruins, Detroit Red Wings, and New York Rangers, are in the playoffs. And it's nothing to do with tariffs. Is Gordie Howe cursing under the ice?
Well, somewhere along the line, you got to rebuild and you've got to get better. And the bottom line is that especially, and the Red Wings have been middling for a long time now. The Rangers were supposed to be better. The thing about all of these sports is that every season it's not just what you're doing. It's what everybody else is doing as well. And so you look at a team like the Bruins, who just a couple of years ago had the best team in the league, and everyone thought that they were going to be a perennial to get to the Stanley Cup. They're in last place this year. And so the teams that you're watching out for that you think are the ones that sort of hang with you every single year, especially there with the 06 are the ones that we all think about. Not very good this year. Get them next year. But you still have two of them up in Canada. You still got the Canadiens who are playing Washington. And you have the strangest stat of all time for me, Scott Simon, which is the birthplace of hockey, Toronto. They've only got 13 Stanley Cups, but they have not been to the Cup Finals in my lifetime. They have not been.
You're a young man and vigorous, but yes.
I'm a young man. 1967, Scott, for a hockey team in Toronto?
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard. That is simply just statistically hard to do. But they've got Austin Matthews. They're a one seed. Let's see what they do.
Yeah. Has it just that the league expanded and American teams were picking up better players? I mean,
some of it is just luck, too. I mean, like, you know, we used to say this when we talked baseball. You know, you would talk about the star-crossed Red Sox and how come the Cubs haven't won in 108 years.
Yeah.
And it's just very difficult to do. I don't even think there is an answer. And it's really funny when you go up there and you talk to Toronto fans. I mean, they sort of roll their eyes at the statistical impracticality, the improbability of it.
Right.
Because everybody at least goes to the Stanley Cup final. I mean, everybody gets to play. The thing about it is, for me, Scott, is that you have a whole bunch of different personnel. You have different generations. You have different ownership. And then this team keeps losing. It's like talking about the Detroit Lions. Nobody gets it, and yet there you go. It's harder to do what they're doing than to actually win.
Yeah, that's true. Howard Brandt of Meadowlark Media, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Scott.
Today marks 250 years since the first battles of the American Revolution. And to commemorate that day, let's revisit a story we originally aired back in 2019.
This is the green behind you. We call it battle green today, but it's really a common.
April 19, 1775, the shot heard round the world was fired on the Lexington, Massachusetts town green.
And Captain Parker, captain of our militia, he knows this is folly. I'm outnumbered. So he tells his men, his militia, to leave, but he never says, lay down your arms. He says, leave.
Jerry Morocco, who gives guided tours in a tri-cornered hat, waistcoat, and breeches, told us,
the first shot of the American Revolution, and to this day, no one knows who fired it. But what's going to happen next? The Redcoats hear a single musket fire, and they panic. Without orders, they start to fire at our militia. Most of our militia have their backs to them. A few scattered shots, and then a scattered volley.
Eight militia, they called themselves rebels then, not yet Americans, fell dead. Rick Atkinson, who wrote the best-selling and greatly honored Liberation Trilogy about the American effort in Europe during the Second World War, has written the first book in a new trilogy to tell the story of the war that made America. It's called The British Are Coming.
Now, if you turn around, folks, and you look across the street here, the Shellow House is called Buckman Tavern. That was the militia's headquarters.
That's where we spoke with Rick Atkinson, right across from the green, where many militia spent the night waiting to see the whites in the eyes of more than 800 British soldiers who'd been sent to stop the American Revolution before it could begin. What happened here, April 19, 1775?
Well, the ambition of the British was to send a force of about 900 men to Concord, 18 miles from Boston, to seize the cannons, the muskets, the gunpowder, the other war material that they knew to be in Concord. Mm-hmm. They got here 12 miles outside of Boston to Lexington, found a small militia force waiting for them, maybe 50 men by the time everything had settled out, and there was a massacre is really what it amounted to. And then they proceeded on to Concord. By that point, Concord was ready for them.
But nobody shouted the actual title of your book.
No, The British Are Coming. The title of the book refers more to the larger theme involved, and of course, it wouldn't have made any sense to people who lived there. They were British. It would be like shouting that we are coming. Subsequently, one of the things that war does is straighten out identity politics. And within a year or two, I think if someone had yelled the British are coming, then people would have understood, meaning the enemy's coming. But it was probably the regulars are coming.
Your portrait of Washington. If anyone needs convincing that he deserves to have his picture on the dollar bill, they will be convinced. But he did make mistakes.
He wasn't a very good tactical general. He does not see the battlefield spatially and temporally the way a great captain does, the way a Napoleon does. What you can see in Washington, though, is a man who, for great responsibility, enlarges him. When he first arrives in Cambridge to take over the Continental Army in the summer of 1775, he's disdainful of New Englanders. He's a Virginian. He doesn't really see how these dirty, obnoxious, obstreperous people, he doesn't really like them. And he doesn't understand the mystical bond between leader and led. He's got to learn that. The relationship that he's got to build with his army is something that we see develop over the first several years of the war.
Washington had a phrase about the difference between an army that was driven and one that was led.
Yeah, he says, and this is in January 1777, after he has nearly lost the war several times and recouped from the disastrous defeat across New Jersey by recrossing the Delaware and capturing the Hessian garrison at Trenton. He says, a people not used to being forced to do things will not be drove. They must be led. And he is a leader. And in the army that he's commanding, the army we have today, actually, that's a fairly critical insight that he's got and a recognition that this is the essence of leadership.
Question must be asked in this day and age. Was the American Revolution truly a revolution for freedom, or was it a white patriarchy of slave owners and apologists for slave owners who simply wanted a bigger slice of the money pie.
I don't think they're necessarily completely contradictory. Certainly you had some people, white slave owners in the South, for example, who felt pinched economically by the restrictions that have been placed on them. But I think that it's not romanticizing that era excessively to believe, particularly when you look at the contemporary writings and what it is they believed at the time, that they had their eye on a grander future than simply a slaveholding country that was a nice place to be if you were white and rich. Really, we sell them short if we don't acknowledge that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator, and all those other fine words out of the Declaration of Independence are things they really believed. They're aspirational, yes.
They didn't really mean it when slaves, obviously, were
500,000 of the 2.5 million people here, it doesn't apply to them. It doesn't apply to women. Yeah. It doesn't apply to the indigent. But it does open a vista into a future in which you can see an egalitarian society that's quite different from the society that existed here in 1775 and is quite different from anything that exists anywhere else on Earth.
What can we learn in today's fractious political environment from that period?
Well, I think one of the things we can learn is that the nation was born disputatiously. It's a very ornery people of 1775, and why should we be surprised that we are an ornery people today? We can also learn that however difficult our difficulties today, we've had much more difficult periods in our national history, and we have not only survived it, we've triumphed ultimately. We can also learn, I think, that in difficult times, leaders have emerged who have helped us to get to where we need to go, and we've been fortunate enough to see men like George Washington and Abraham Lincoln and Dwight Eisenhower, and there's a long list of them. And they share frequently a list of traits that we recognize as really admirable among our leaders. And we should demand that. We should be insistent that good, noble, accomplished people be led by good, noble, accomplished leaders. I think that that comes through clearly from the period of the Revolution and the early Republic.
Rick Atkinson speaking with us back in 2019 at Buckman Tavern in Lexington, Mass., about his book, The British Are Coming. A powerful title, even if nobody ever actually said it. And back with us on the 250th anniversary of the battles of Lexington and Concord is Rick Atkinson. Rick, thanks so much for being with us again.
Thank you, Scott. It's great to see you again.
Do Americans appreciate today how long and costly to human life the American Revolution was?
You know, there's something about the Revolution where over 250 years, the blood has been bleached out of it. It has kind of a sepia tint, like an old lithograph, when in fact, for 8 years, it was a terribly bloody affair. It was a civil war, our first civil war. We had at least 25,000 American dead in the American Revolution, maybe as many as 35,000. That is the largest proportion of our population of any of our wars other than the Civil War.
Rick Atkinson, how are you marking this day?
I'm looking forward to the whole semi-quincentennial era.
Thank you for being the one to pronounce it. I was trying to avoid it, yeah.
Takes some practice, but the semi-quincentennial begins today and it's going to stretch at least through July 4th, 2026, and in some cases it'll stretch into, God help us, 2033. I think it's a good opportunity for us to take a deep breath, take one step back, be grateful for those who've sacrificed what they've sacrificed over the years, what they did 250 years ago, to remember that we have been through perils before. We've been through existential perils, and it should give us a sense that we've got a strong foundation and we've got strength for dealing with whatever ails us today.
Rick Atkinson, the second book in his trilogy on the American Revolution, The Fate of the Day, is out later this month. Rick, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Scott.
And you're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. It's roughly the same size as an emperor penguin, weighs about 100 pounds, and you can take bites out of it, but shouldn't. Any guesses as to what it is? The confectioners at Cadbury have unveiled what they say is the world's largest cream egg in these days before Easter. The formidable egg is on display at Cadbury World in Birmingham, England. And from there, we're joined by Dawn Jenks, one of the chocolatiers behind the creation. Thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
How do you make a cream egg this big?
We have a mold. We make it in two halves. And we piped the wrapper by hand inside to the mold first, and then we put the milk chocolate in afterwards.
Mm. And why? I mean, why this challenge?
Because we wanted to create the world's biggest Cadbury cream egg. Lots of people have claimed to have made it, but we're the only ones who have the secret recipe for the fondant.
Oh, a secret recipe. So what is it? Just between you and me?
Oh, I can't tell you.
All right.
Not allowed.
How do you get all that gooey fondant filling into the egg?
So we cut the top off once we'd stuck it together, and then we pour the fondant inside, and then the yellow that's the yolk, we pipe that onto the top of the white.
Yeah. Forgive me, ever lick your fingers?
No, not allowed.
Oh, all right. I just thought I'd ask. And any, you know, now and then spills or other accidents?
Oh, there are some spillages, but, you know, we don't eat them.
All right. Cadbury has a tradition in this regard, I'm told. What are some other Cadbury creations with which you've been involved?
Yeah, so we work at Cadbury World, which is a visitor center. So we are not the factory. So guests can come round and see the things that we make. We've made lots of things. We've done a crown for the Jubilee. We've built the Globe Theatre, the Shakespeare's Theatre as well. And lots of various different Christmas and Halloween creations as well.
The Globe Theatre made out of chocolate?
Yep, not full size, obviously.
Is there something you would aspire to make out of chocolate but haven't yet had the chance?
Yep, maybe a VW camper van. Could be a bit of a challenge, but quite an exciting one.
A Volkswagen camper van. Oh, all right.
Yeah.
With sliding doors?
Of course. You need to get in and out.
I am told, Ms. Jenks, that nobody is actually going to get to eat this cream egg, right?
No, no one will eat it, but it will remain on display here at Cadbury World for our guests to enjoy and have their photographs taken with.
To enjoy, but just like visually, right? Not enjoy.
No, it's covered with a case, so they can't actually get at it.
I mean, 100 pounds of chocolate could make, 1,000 kids very happy, don't you think?
It might also make them sick, so maybe not.
All right, they'd probably stay up all night anyway. Dawn Jenks, who is a chocolatier for Cadbury in Birmingham, the UK. Thanks so much for joining us, and happy holiday to you.
You're welcome. Happy Easter. Bye.
Weekend Edition is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. Like a story you heard on this or another NPR program? Share it with a friend at npr.org. While there, you can also hear stories you missed, enjoy expanded content, or connect to your favorite member station.
This is NPR News.
In The Shrouds, director David Cronenberg tells the story of a man who can't seem to let go of his wife after her death. But his grief takes an extreme, visceral form.
For him, her death was a physical event. And so he's naturally focused on what he has left of her, her body.
That conversation Sunday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Thank you.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. The U.S. and Iran agreed to hold another round of talks next week on Iran's nuclear program after today's session. They're attempting to make progress towards a deal that would lift economic sanctions in exchange for Iran curtailing its nuclear program. Vice President J.D. Vance met today with senior officials at the Vatican. The church has criticized Trump administration policies, such as deporting millions of migrants and slashing aid programs. And the Trump administration has canceled the construction of a multi-billion-dollar offshore wind project near Long Island, saying it needs more study. The project was designed to supply electricity to 500,000 customers. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive. Progressive Commercial Insurance protects small businesses from retailers to tradespeople. Progressive covers a variety of business needs with a range of coverages. More at progressivecommercial.com. From CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. When people with a severe mental illness go into crisis, they often cycle through ERs, jails, shelters, state psychiatric hospitals, and many never get out of that cycle. Now Montana lawmakers are deciding how to use their resources to try to better serve those people. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton explains what's at stake.
Kay is 65 years old and lives in the mountain town of Missoula. She's been homeless for 8 years and has schizoaffective disorder. She experiences severe mood swings and delusions. Kay's daughter explains she also has anosognosia.
They do not know they're mentally ill.
That's why Kay often refuses medications and treatment. Her daughter Elle asked NPR to only identify them by their first initials to protect Kay's ability to rent an apartment in the future. A few years ago, while living in Colorado, Elle found out her mom wasn't receiving any mental health services and kept getting kicked out of the shelter.
Mind you, she's sick. And I truly just didn't understand the dynamic of these services.
When she's in crisis, Kay cycles through jails, emergency rooms, and the state psychiatric hospital. But it always leads back to the same place, Kay unmedicated and alone on the streets. So Elle moved back to Missoula to help her mom get support services and find housing. That's when she met Teresa Williams, who leads Missoula County's crisis intervention team. They take on tough cases like Kay's.
We're talking years and years and years of this particular individual falling through the cracks of our community.
Elle and Williams decided the first step was getting Kay to the state hospital, where she could be involuntarily medicated.
We were kind of hoping that this intervention at the state hospital would help with stabilization.
2 years ago, Montana appropriated $300 million to help rebuild its crumbling mental health system. But lawmakers are still debating how to spend that money. In Missoula County alone, there are about 100 people like Kay who cycle in and out of jail and mental health facilities. Matt Jennings is the county attorney.
These people still do get out of a hospital setting. They get out of a step-down facility, and they go back into a homeless situation here in Missoula or Billings or somewhere else in the state. And then the cycle repeats itself because there isn't a long-term plan.
About $16 million has been set aside for specialized housing for people like Kay. But Jennings says it's not enough. Ben Miller is a professor at Stanford University who studies mental health reform. He agrees that mental illness and the housing shortage are intertwined.
If you just get someone stable housing, you can watch how their mental health, the benefits go up almost overnight.
He says lawmakers here and in other states tend to spend money on short-term crisis services rather than things that can provide long-term mental stability like housing. But finding the right balance is hard.
Our communities are suffering because we're not doing both very well.
turned out. Oh, they just like attention.
No, 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 you're off.
At Elle's house in Missoula, she sits on the couch with her two dogs. It's been over a year since the state hospital had her mother, Kay, involuntarily medicated. It did not go well. Elle says her mom was given the wrong medication at first. But after she was discharged, Kay eventually agreed to take her meds more often.
My mom does have some sort of a life back.
Elle says she's done all she can, but her mom still doesn't have stable housing. And Elle says she's too disruptive to care for at home.
And it's pretty painful on cold nights to have to not let somebody in because it will deteriorate your whole mental health and stability.
Elle has decided to move out of state to get some of her old life back.
And so I will always help her moving forward. But I also have to put myself first too, because I don't have anyone else doing that.
Kay has agreed to get on waiting lists for group homes and assisted living. Elle hopes that when a bed opens up, her mom will be well enough then and agree to take it. For NPR News, I'm Aaron Bolton in Missoula, Montana.
And that story comes from NPR's partnership with Montana Public Radio and KFF Health News. Syria, the ruins of Palmyra are still standing, but years of civil war and ISIS occupation have battered the ancient Roman city.
Gosh, before it was a big square building with intact pillars, and now it's giant blocks lying on top of each other.
Later today on All Things Considered, a tour through what's left of Palmyra. You can listen by telling your smart speaker to play NPR or your member station by name. As the end of the school year approaches, it's easy to ask yourself, where did the year go? Then add in your goals for summer break or graduation plans, and this transition period can feel overwhelming. But one mature Miami-Dade college student story, a finalist in last year's NPR College Podcast Challenge, reminds us you are not alone in this journey, no matter your age. Here's Iman Ma'ani with the story.
Meet Anna Bassett, a 48-year-old mother of four and college student in Miami.
Do you feel that you need to reassess your place in the world as you realize you have lived half your life?
It was in her late 40s that Anna enrolled at Miami-Dade College to finish her degree.
Do you ever ask yourself, how do I stay relevant and remain valuable as I grow older? Do you think getting older means you will be outdated or dismissed? I think about these things, and I'm sure I'm not alone.
She made a podcast about her experience of returning to school. Her podcast, midway through, was one of our finalists in the 2023 NPR Podcast Challenge.
I felt I wanted and needed a change, so I went looking to fulfill a dream of mine.
Anna had dreamt of becoming a mental health therapist after high school, but she ended up dropping out of college in sophomore year. It was after becoming a mother that she had to put her own dreams on hold.
Over time, I felt lost. Lost because I stopped taking time to hear my voice, to check in with myself. Eventually, I realized I was living through my kids, experiencing joy and pride in their experiences, but I lacked my own.
Anna tells us in her podcast that it wasn't an easy decision to go back.
I had doubts about doing this at my age. It had been 28 years since I was last in a classroom. I didn't want to keep longing for a second chance.
But her experience in motherhood came in handy. It taught her how to be resourceful, problem solve, and work efficiently and independently.
I'm going after my dream to find self-fulfillment outside of motherhood. This semester, I've accomplished that. So far, I've aced all my assignments while still balancing mom duties and home responsibilities. I'm so proud of myself for that.
She also has the support of her whole family, including her now grown-up son.
For me, it's very inspiring to see you going back to college.
That's Anna's son, Julian.
Because you're proving that no matter how many times you may let go of your dreams, you can always get them back and you can always follow them.
He's her second eldest of four, and he studied at Miami-Dade with his mom.
You're creating a second chance for yourself at a time in your life where not many other people think they could do the same.
Anna graduated with an associate's degree in psychology from Miami-Dade College last May. She's taking a break before she returns to school to study counseling to become a therapist. Iman Ma'ani, NPR News.
Angela and Lee and Kristen Mann are both couples, one two women, the other two men, all good friends living in Seattle. Angela and Lee are focused on their ongoing efforts to bring a child into their lives. But the two women are running out of money for their IVF procedures.
Chris and I will be very good gunkles. We can babysit any time. I'll teach the baby art and Chris will change the diapers.
And the other couple, Min, who is Korean, wants to marry Chris, a love match. But Chris is shy about commitments. And so Min, who is from a wealthy industrial Korean family, has a bold idea. Why doesn't he just marry their friend Angela and pay for her IVF treatments so she and Lee could have a child and he can stay in the U.S. with Chris? What could possibly go wrong? And the story really begins. The Wedding Banquet is a new film directed by Andrew Ahn. Andrew Ahn joins us now from New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Min's grandmother is so beautifully played by the Oscar-winning actress Yoon-Yo Jung. She suddenly comes to town. She senses a scheme, but still wants a big wedding ceremony, Korean ceremony. Why?
Yeah, you know, I think that this film is so much about parenting, and there's an intergenerational conflict about, you know, the values and priorities of one generation over another. And I wanted to show how, you know, even though these characters care for each other, that they can, you know, not see eye to eye, and that parenting in many ways is a process of understanding each other's priorities.
Mm. Oh, and Angela's mother, so beautifully played by Joan Chen, she's all right with the plan, but she's concerned it might change her public image, isn't she?
Yes, it was a fun update for me, you know, in thinking about how much has changed in the past 30 years since, you know, the original Ang Lee's The Wedding Banquet. And you know, one of those fun changes is that, you know, what if we showed an Asian American mother who was overly enthusiastic about her daughter being queer? And so she's winning awards for being a great queer ally and is kind of overcompensating for some past trauma that they are going to have to deal with in order for Angela to feel good about her becoming a mother.
You have, at the center of this film, of course, is four LGBTQ people living very openly. But still in this day and age, each of them has their own story about the challenges of coming out, don't they?
It's still so difficult as queer people to live, you know, holistic, whole lives. You know, I think we are code switching. You know, I think about how we have to navigate kind of different levels of outedness and, you know, who we are to some people in certain spaces. And I wanted to show how, you know, complicated the lives of queer people can be, just even amongst ourselves.
So many strong actors in this film, including obviously an Academy Award winner and then an Oscar nominee, Lily Gladstone, and Joan Chen, who is also a director herself. Was this intimidating for you?
You know, it could have been, for sure, but this was such an incredible ensemble and everybody was so generous. You know, I'll say there was one moment I was a little bit scared. It was the very first take of the very first scene that I shot with Academy Award winner Yoon-Yo Jung. I went up to her after the first take and I said, "That was lovely. Can we go again?" And she looked at me and she said, "Andrew, if that was really lovely, we wouldn't have to go again." And then she told me, "You know, American directors are so nice. You don't have to be so nice. Just give me the note and we'll go again." And, you know, I really appreciated that, you know, she was so honest and direct, and that made for a really lovely collaboration.
The French think they've come up with really a brilliant plan. But like a lot of brilliant plans, there's an unforeseen doozy of a complication, isn't there?
Of course, yeah. You know, I think it's so interesting working from, you know, the original Ang Lee film, just trying to find ways to update things. And, you know, in the original film, you know, gay people couldn't get married. But 30 years later, now we can. Why would you have a fake straight wedding? And then I realized, oh, there's many reasons why, you know, queer people might not want to get married. You know, that burden of choice, you know, that I think a lot of millennials feel, and this fear that maybe you'll ruin something that's already so good. And I thought a lot about, you know, my relationship with my boyfriend and the conversations that we've had about commitment and building family in the creation and development of this wedding banquet.
Seems to me a moment when all four of the major characters who are staging an event are suddenly sobered when they hear a member of the clergy say, "I hope you find happiness together."
Yeah, you know, I think I wanted to show a Korean wedding in the film, and I wanted to show tradition and ritual and how it's incredibly important in our lives, even if it may not suit us. You know, I saw my brother get married about a decade ago, and I saw him go through this traditional Korean wedding ceremony. You know, I saw how it brought him closer to my parents, it brought him closer to his wife, it brought him closer to his Korean identity. And as a gay man, I wondered if I could ever participate in something like that. And it made me very sad. And so in many ways, my writing, you know, this film with my co-writer James Seamus was, you know, my way of throwing myself my own Korean wedding and trying to be a part of that tradition and maybe try and make it more inclusive, you know, queer it a little bit.
And I do have to ask, did anybody ever say you'll never get the money together to make a film like this?
Of course, you know. I remember when I had my first feature at Sundance, it was a film called Spa Night. I couldn't imagine, you know, having a career, you know, making queer and Asian American films. And that made me so sad because I feel like there are so many beautiful stories within our community. You know, I think cinema has to be reflective of, you know, the world that we live in, and it's diverse and it's queer and it's, you know, funny and it's sad. You know, like, I think it's really important that people get to tell stories about, you know, who they are, personal stories. You know, it's been a real honor to my community that I've been able to, you know, focus my career on, you know, people that I love.
Andrew Ahn has directed the new film, The Wedding Banquet, in theaters now. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
And you're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indiana University, establishing the IU Launch Accelerator for Biosciences to drive healthcare discoveries and train the next generation of innovators. More at go.iu.edu/IULab. And from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. This is NPR.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.
You left me and now I'm doing fine. My troubles and sorrows are behind. I've found that a stitching time saves time. So don't hang your dirty linen on my line. Don't hang your dirty linen on my line. Your worst days, your worries are not mine. You cheated and you drank the devil's wine. So don't hang your dirty linen on my line.